Hello and welcome back to this week's edition of Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. My guest today is thankfully a frequent visitor, XA Global Trading Advisory CEO Donald McKay. And I asked him to come back because two things have been bothering me. First of all, the world seems to be going absolutely crazy. Old notions of left and right are no longer helpful. In the US, Joe Biden may be a fierce critic of Donald Trump's, but he's implementing precisely the same economic policies Trump was elected for back in 2016. Close the American borders or close the borders, bring jobs back home. Now, I remember Russian leader Vladimir Putin bragging to somebody 5 years or so, 3 years or so ago, that liberal democracy was dead. And that was one thing, but is globalization really dead too? Liberal democracy has been so successful, it seems to me, creating almost untold wealth and security with the people lucky enough to live under it and to live under its warm embrace. Now it seems all over. We are still a democracy here in South Africa, a new one. But even here, the drums beat loudly for a sort of pivot to something much darker. You know, you can't eat your vote, complain. The world just seems to be closing in on itself. Certainly the big countries are. But perhaps, Donald, they can afford to. What about small economies with very small domestic markets? How do we best respond to all of this? If you look at our industrial policies and our trade policies, which seem to be a sort of proxy for the wider ideological debate in the world, we're also shrinking from the world, trying to localize, trying to reindustrialize. Surely it's all too late for that in the real world. Manufacturing seems so 1990s. What's the state of play, Donald, in South Africa? Is localization working? Are the master plans trade, industry and competition minister Ebrahim Patel working like he says they are?
Hi, Peter. So I worked through the minister's report that he had given on industrial policy maybe 10 days ago or so. And what struck me when reading the document, I thought for a moment I was living in a country with a successful economy and a shrinking unemployment rate. So the document talks about the successes of industrial policy. And of course, there are successes at a micro level. But it certainly is not putting a dent into any of the macro performance indicators that we care about, such as unemployment. I see today there's new unemployment numbers out. Unemployment rate has increased. Number of people employed has remained consistent, but another 300,000 people have entered the workforce without work. So it's hard for me to see how our industrial policy is having a positive benefit on the market. What it has done, though, is it's created a tremendous rent for the small number of winners, and it has socialized this cost across the whole economy. So all of us pay a little bit more so that a few people can make a lot more.
And how does that work, Donald? Let's explain that to listeners. Who is this small elite? How did they get to be there in the first place? And who put them there?
Well, that's an interesting question to which I don't entirely have an answer. We don't know how it is that some people are able to get into the room and other people don't even know there is a room that they can be in. So that certainly is a problem. We shouldn't think of these master plan meetings as a place where there's a proper representation of industry. So if we take, for example, the Steel Master Plan has an oversight committee, but then periodically you would have a working group pop up, and the working group would lobby without the knowledge of the rest of the oversight committee for a particular position. Most recently, the positions we've seen on scrap metal exports. And one never knows who the members of these working groups are. So not even, I might add, quite often the other oversight committee members. So we don't have a situation where industry meets with government and labor. Instead, we have a select group of people who then have preferential access to the relevant politician where they can lobby for a position, in this case, to Minister Patel. But of course, the master plans have broken free from the DTIC and they're now present everywhere.
But originally and largely still, to become part of the master planning environment, because this is the elite I think you're talking about. The people invited into the master plan are there by virtue of what? Are they simply the biggest players in the respective field, be it steel or textiles or transport or whatever it might be, automobiles? Or what are the criteria? What gets you invited into the inner workings and to the inner chambers? What makes you a master plan champion, which is, I think, what some of the CEOs were originally called?
I mean, Peter, this sounds ridiculous, but I honestly don't know. So I will give you an example. In some master plans, again, if we go back to steel, the scrap metal sector has been denied a seat at the table. At the same time, we have people on some of the committees that are not even in the sector that get a seat there, but other people in the sector can't get a seat. We have, we don't appear to have a consistent kind of criteria that's applied. Again, if we go back, and I apologize for harping on the steel plan, but it's perhaps one of the more ludicrous ones. We have folk at the steel master plan formulating policy for the non-ferrous metal sector, which has no representation, predictably, on the steel master plan. So, for example, when the decision was taken to extend the export duties to ferrous metals as well as non-ferrous metals, that arose from a working group at the steel master plan, none of whom are in the non-ferrous metal sector, but who lobbied and still got changes made in the non-ferrous metal sector as well. So I have no real explanation of how people get there. It should be to get a fair representation of the sector, but it certainly is not always the case. Some are more representative than others.
Just explain. So you say export duty. So in order to export, you've got to pay the government for the privilege, or is this right? Is it?
Yes.
And when were they? Sorry, I'm behind the curve, which is not untypical. Are export duties a common feature in economies like ours?
No. Well, they're more common than I'd like to believe. We have them in Argentina. We certainly have them in places like China. Most economists agree that they're not a good idea. We typically want to encourage people to export, not penalize them. But of course, the export duties are typically used so that you get domestic beneficiation inside the country. So to ensure that the scrap metal doesn't leave at a globally high price, you penalize the exporter. And if it's steel, you pay a 20% duty. If it's copper, I think it's a 10% and so on, in order to take the product out. So it's just another mechanism to force down the price of the product being exported, to discourage the export.
I think it's quite extraordinary that we would want to limit exporting in any way. I would have thought that would be the only way out for an economy our size. We have a very, very small domestic market. I know we think that one day there'll be a big market in Africa, which we think we're going to have all to ourselves. But you know, the only thing that I would want to see happening in exports is some sort of support for exports rather than a limitation. But sorry, Donald, I interrupted you. You were talking about how the elite gets together, how people are excluded. Are we creating? Look, we've always been, you know, multi-level economy, sort of, you know, with the tops and bottoms and riches and rich and poor. But we're supposed to be, as a democracy, better than we used to be as a non-democracy. Is that not happening?
Some of the names of the companies have changed, but essentially the structure of economy looks very similar to what it did under apartheid. So perhaps not with the crazy groups that we had, you know, where Anglo-American owned beer-making companies and owned a bookstore and all sorts of stuff. But we still see the economy dominated by a small number of highly concentrated industries. So from that perspective, we still have the apartheid sort of shape, even if the details are a bit different.
And does manufacturing, because this is particularly where Patel concentrates, I mean, where in the world does manufacturing, and other than China, which of course is plain for all to see, this is with an internal market of 2 billion people, where does manufacturing in today's world continue to create new jobs? Where is it growing jobs that you can think of?
Yeah, so what, you know, I guess perhaps before I answer that question, you know, we've got to ask ourselves what South Africa's future looks like as a manufacturer. I mean, I'm not saying we should manufacture nothing, but it'll be increasingly difficult for South Africa to manufacture because we have a primitive education system for the vast majority of South Africans, and a small number have a decent education, and manufacturing requires fairly high skill levels. So any kind of complicated manufacture, which isn't sort of assembly like we have in the automotive, will be increasingly difficult to do, I would think. And we don't appear to be addressing this education deficit. And so I can't see how manufacturing gets going. I personally think services are more important for South Africa to focus on. Number one, they use less electricity. And number two, it's far easier to train someone up to work in the tourism sector or, you know, call center than it is to become a fitter and turner or a welder or some such thing. And so, you know, I think we have to deal with the economy that we have rather than the one we wish we had. And to answer your question globally, well, you know, manufacture, I think, will find itself concentrated in fewer and fewer places over time. We already see some of this. So manufacturing jobs can shift between China and the US because the US gives big subsidies and has now just whacked China with a whole lot of new duties. But this is not an increase in manufacturing. It's merely a relocation from one place to another. The challenge I think we're running into with artificial intelligence and just far better and more sophisticated manufacturing processes, that the kind of era of manufacturing heyday, which, you know, the 1950s idea of getting a job at Ford and kind of staying there for the rest of your life and earning a good income, I think are mostly over. There are some subsectors, perhaps in semiconductors and a few others where that will continue. But I think for the most part, those will be concentrated in countries like China, the US, Europe. I don't see South Africa really playing in that space, which kind of leaves us with perhaps trying to manufacture wheelbarrows or whatever else it might be. But even there, we're unable to compete with India, China, etc.
What's the alternative, Donald? I mean, what sort of economy should we be? What sort of what should we be chasing?
Well, I think we've got to create a better environment to do business in, rather than trying to pick winners or losers, which, you know, we, like just about every other government around the world, turns out to be quite bad at doing. So I think, you know, the sectors that we're competitive in will manifest themselves. If we have better educated, and I apologize for harping on education, but it is important. If we have a better educated workforce and a better trained workforce, then more opportunities will present themselves. Unemployed people will be able to come up with better ideas than selling sweets at the taxi rank. But the problem is we make that very difficult. And so we're kind of dependent on government to figure out what to do. And our government, along with many others, have proven themselves wholly incapable of doing this at scale. So I don't think we should have that kind of focus. I think we've got to get a much stronger focus on the fundamentals that allow people to be more productive rather than trying to work out the sectors. But if we were to, I would say services in the broadest sense makes a lot more sense. Just it's less capital intensive, lower skill levels, less energy intensive, doesn't require the ports to work terribly well. You know, maybe one day that changes, but I think we've got to, like I said, we've got to deal with the structure of our demographics and our economy as it is right at this moment.
It's incredible, really, because when you, I've just been looking, I've been reading a little bit about the American experience with what they call with onshoring. This is bringing factories back from China or wherever else American companies might have been manufacturing. And this was a big thing of Donald Trump's in his first term, and Joe Biden has probably doubled down on that in a sense, and in fact enacted far-reaching legislation to encourage it. But if you look at the American manufacturing and industrial output numbers, they literally haven't changed in 10 years. It's made no impact. If there are jobs being created in the U.S., and we know there are, they're not in manufacturing. Well, they don't seem to be in manufacturing, according to the statistics. It's a very hard thing to give up on. I mean, if we were to say to ourselves in South Africa, okay, well, we won't make wheelbarrows here any longer, along with a long list of other things. I suppose, in a way, you have to support the effort to try to make them. The question is whether trying to make wheelbarrows or whatever, you know, including the bearings that the wheels might run on, which is also a very difficult industry to be in. If you're not going to manufacture and you've got the unemployment that we have and you've got the coming unemployment that we are getting in terms of the number of people, we've got a growing population in this country, not a shrinking one. There must be another way to do it. And I haven't seen it yet. You know, I know that the DA came up with an economic policy finally, and it was great to see the effort being made. But it was, you know, it was apart from promising to create 2 million jobs in 5 years, it didn't really have a sort of gut punch. I didn't feel as if it really hit me. You know, was there a magic bullet somewhere in economic policy that it had found? I don't know whether you read the policy, but I'm still looking somewhere in South Africa for a bullet that says, listen, you know, here's the way forward, or not magic, but just something that we can all support or congregate around or not be divided by. Long question without a question mark at the end.
Peter, I think much of the problems we have at the moment is we've tried to kind of gimmick our way into success. You know, we've said, well, we have relative to our median wage, we have of the highest kind of minimum wage ratio to median wage in the world. So it's higher than our median wage. And you know, we've got a poorly educated workforce, and there's, you know, every time you set a minimum wage, you're also saying to the employer, this is the minimum amount of value this person will add to your business. You know, if you pay someone 5,000 rand a month and they can't add at least 5,001 rand a month in value, there's no point in employing them. So I think, you know, we're going to have at some point a very uncomfortable conversation between the unions, which of course govern the country, and the business sector to say, can we continue with labor laws which protect the employed at the expense of the unemployed? So maybe fiddling with the minimum wage is not the answer, but I struggle to see how we drive up employment when that is yet another barrier on top. So, I mean, I guess of all of the policies, that one stood out. But I'm not sure there is a single thing to be done. We've neglected education for 30 years, and we're paying a terrible price for that. But you can't fix that immediately, yet we're still doing nothing to address it. I don't think we can fix the economy by subsidizing sectors that don't work, or by endlessly giving import duty protection so that people don't have to confront the real world. In that world, our market is as big as South Africa. And given that South Africa is a poor country, we have almost no prospect for growth. You know, so we're going to have to address South Africa's extremely low levels of labor productivity, we're going to have to address the fact that we're an expensive country to manufacture in, despite the fact that we have a huge unemployed population. I'm not sure that there's a magic bullet. I think we've got to get back to the basics. But of course, that's a terrible election slogan. No one really cares about the basics.
Well, nobody cares to go back either, you know. I mean, so I guess one of the bullets would be, you know, the discovery of a rather large amount of oil offshore, or the rather large amount of gas offshore. But it kind of leads you into the American trap, or the trap that America is in, because you know, it became this huge producer of oil. I'm not sure when it was, a century ago, and sort of manufacturing almost became, you know, so oil was a big export. America's the biggest producer of oil, I think, in the world at the moment, oil and gas. I'm not.
Yes.
I mean, I know there are.
Yes, it is.
So, you know, you don't have to worry all that much about manufacturing. And I think people call it the Dutch disease, you know, where you put all your eggs in the one basket and suddenly it all comes back to bite you. It seems to me that what we have failed signally to do is to concentrate on the three obvious things that we are good at. You know, we are miners, we are farmers, and we can, you know, we've got the potential to be a big tourist destination. Those three seem to me to be just obvious. You know, a minister of any of those three surely has got to have the best job in the world, because they can really, really make a difference.
Yeah. So, if we have a big oil or gas or insert whatever other resource we find, I don't believe it'll make a difference at all, Peter. We sit on enormous mineral resources, and they've done absolutely nothing for improving the lives of the average person in South Africa. So we haven't been clever with the resources we have. We've inserted far too many ridiculous requirements to participate in that part of the economy, which has just been sucked off by people with familiar surnames as a rent. So we, you know, this will simply continue because it's the easiest thing in the world. And, you know, we don't want an economy which starts to look like many of the Middle Eastern economies, where you've got a small number of very wealthy people, and then you've got everyone else kind of dependent on the state for their largesse. I think that's
where we already are.
Yes, we are. But I don't think adding, you know, if we discovered just massive amounts of the most important critical minerals for batteries, it would make some mining companies wealthier. There would no doubt be some connected politicians who would make a fortune. But I don't think it would shift the needle in South Africa at all. Simply because we don't have an ability to utilize the value that we have under the soil at the moment. It's just become a place for a politician to extract whatever they can.
What happens to this discussion sort of post the May 29th election? I mean, does industrial policy just carry on its merry way, where the politicians literally make up numbers to, you know, whether they're real or not, one doesn't know. I remember Ibrahim Patel, when he first started off on the master plans, was fond of quoting the number of jobs he had saved, which is a very difficult thing to do normally, I would have thought. But it never stopped him from making, you know, sort of large claims. And I see, you know, in the review, as you mentioned at the beginning of this discussion, on the review, the five-year review that he published the other day, he's done incredibly well. But you know, the numbers, the stats don't show it. The stats don't show reindustrialization occurring in any measurable way. And surely that has to change. Surely something has to happen. I mean, it's not as if he's a bad minister. I mean, he's, you know, if you're Cyril Ramaphosa, if, you know, he's probably ticked off more of his what do you call it, a performance plan, performance review with Cyril 5 years ago than any other minister, almost no real effect.
Yeah, so I mean, I have no idea what happens post May 29th, but I think industrial policy as a central pillar of the government's economic policy is very dependent on Ibrahim Patel remaining in that portfolio. I'm not sure that there is the kind of buy-in to the idea, nor anyone else with his kind of energy and drive, that would step in. So I think if he remains, industrial policy remains. I think if he's replaced, and I have no idea who would replace him, I mean, possibly not even someone from the ANC, we'd have to see. But I think for as long as he is there, we will have industrial policy. And I think he means well, but I don't think there's been a measurable positive outcome at all.
No, and it's interesting, you know, so there's a, I don't know whether you've ever read her, the woman, very well known now, an economic advisor to many governments, Mariana Mazzucato. I think an Italian American, lives in London, advises the South African government. She became well known a few years ago when she started writing about the entrepreneurial state and how states could be, could lead enterprise. I suppose one of the examples would be, you know, the Americans' space program and the offshoots of that in private industry. And I remember people like Pravin Gordhan and Cyril Ramaphosa as well were very taken with what she was saying because it made this kind of holistic sense. You know, the state can do the sort of initial work, and this is largely why. This is certainly the rationale behind why Pravin Gordhan stayed for as long as he did in public enterprises, because he thought that he could, you know, somehow direct the economy in the right way. But Mariana Mazzucato has now become the high priestess of industrial policy, advising governments on. And it's quite what's so interesting about what she writes is that it's exactly what Patel is doing, but he's not necessarily following what she said, because he told us what he was going to do, given the powers, back in 2009 when he first drew up the new growth path, which you'll remember. But listen, you know, to listen to Mariana Mazzucato now. She's writing, and this is a recent paper, "To truly benefit working people, U.S. industrial policy must help bring about a new social contract between the state and business and between capital and labor that is focused on the common good and on restoring public trust in the state. It can redefine the terms of these relationships. Governments can make access to public funding and other benefits bestowed by the state conditional on firms behaving in ways that maximize public value. For example, a firm that receives loans or tax benefits from the state could be required to ensure that the goods, services, and technologies it produces remain accessible and affordable, and to share its intellectual property with others." That's very recognizable stuff to anybody who watches the sort of march of South African policy. It's exactly what the ANC is trying to do. The question is, does it work or not?
Yeah,
will it work?
If we kind of just I have no reason to think it will. I'm skeptical of the whole idea. I think government has an important role to play in the economy, but it needs to stick to its primary role. You know, when we attempt to intervene in spaces where there isn't a problem in the market, that's a problem. So if we look, for example, at the Competition Commission, it has a go at one sector after another. The minister lists all of the successes. But if you look at the most harmful, highly concentrated companies in the economy, these are all state-owned enterprises.
Yeah.
And Yeah, they remain untouched, but the just incredible harm that Eskom has caused to the South African economy, with this ridiculous rule that you couldn't self-generate power. And we look at the tremendous change that has occurred by just allowing competition into the market. I mean, whether it be private or public sector, I think is almost secondary. But the fact that you have competition, look at how it has driven down the cost of solar, et cetera. So I think, you know, the challenge we have is the way that the market allocates resources is that when I make a bad decision, I overpay for something, I am punished. And if I do it often enough, I go out of business. But of course, the idea of a state-owned enterprise going out of business just doesn't exist. You know, they kind of live on in a zombie form forever. And so the challenge with that is that the signal tends to not get through, which means really incredibly inefficient behavior has no consequence attached. I mean, if we consider SAA for a moment, they received, I read the other day, I think over 50 billion rand in bailouts and subsidies over the years. Kalula, which was a great airline, made some bad decisions and simply went out of business. I mean, that is what happens. And that is the signal the market needs to get to not make that mistake again. You know, but that message never gets through to the likes of an SAA. And I think with industrial policy, we run into the same risk, which is when you are one of the preferred companies or sectors in the market, you don't have an ability to fail any longer. And so the more efficient businesses are simply kept out of the market because you keep the inefficient monopoly locked in place in perpetuity. And that is what I fear happens here. So, you know, even if we think it's a good idea, for example, for all of these mini mills to be manufacturing lots and lots of steel out of scrap metal, the fact is the IDC has invested 14 billion rand into the mini mill sector, which accounts for about 30% of the steel produced in South Africa, and ArcelorMittal, which produces 50% of the steel in South Africa, has a market capitalization of about 1.5 billion. And so this is clearly problematic. But how does that happen? Well, you have interference in the market that forces down artificially the price of the raw material. So you make Ford, Toyota, et cetera, recover less money on their scrap metal. And you pass that value through to the likes of a Score Metal or a Cape Gate or whoever the mini mill might be. And you couple that with cheap finance. And what you end up with is overinvestment in the sector. And you then have a position where government finds it very hard to walk back that position because the IDC's loan book is protected by industrial policy. So we don't have this with other banks. And so other banks would look at this and say, no, we're not going to finance a business in that sector. There are too many of them in that sector. We're worried we won't get our money back. But the IDC will fund that business, and they don't really care about whether they get their money back or not. And so that's the fundamental difference, I guess, Peter, that the misallocation of resources. And I mean, even without industrial policy, just think about how badly we've allocated South Africa's resources in the last 30 years.
Give me an example.
Well, if we have a look at the PIC, for example, and the amount of money that went into Iqbal Surveys businesses which certainly people I've spoken to who understand the space better than me. Do not believe are worth a fraction of the kind of money that went in there. He's become an incredibly wealthy man, but it's hard for me to see how he has added value to the economy greater than the amount he has extracted from it. And that extraction was enabled by government making business decisions, just driven by motives other than normally making a profit.
So are we creating a sort of generation of sort of slapshot business types through this sort of central planning, central, you know, the government literally with a finger in every possible power. I mean, the conditionalities for any of these programs now being run by Patel are phenomenal. You pointed out one the other day in a very nice piece on the textile industry, where you made the point, and I've got it in front of me. You say, so the retail clothing, textile, footwear, and leather industry, CTFL, you say the CTFL master plan attempts to develop the industry through an incredibly complicated set of steps. It offers clothing manufacturers lower import duties on import textiles in return for them committing to a minimum purchase quota of textiles made by South African mills. In turn, they can sell this clothing only to local retailers who've signed up to the master plan. Everything is dependent on everything else. This is very much in the sort of frame of what Marianne Mazzucato is now suggesting Joe Biden do as well, make everything dependent on everything else, which, you know, it might sound good on paper, but I mean, it just doesn't work like that in the real world, does it, Donald?
No, it doesn't. And I'm particularly for the companies that are not signatories to the master plan, but are still operating in South Africa. So they're at an immediate disadvantage. And you'd say, well, and Minister Patel has said this, you know, just sign up to the master plan and you get these benefits. But the problem is you can't sign up to the master plan if you also do not belong to the bargaining council.
Oh, and really? So you've got to pay the wage.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes, yes. So you've got to do all of that. Now, if you're a retailer that isn't a signatory to the master plan, you're in fact incentivized not to buy your product from a domestic supplier. I mean, why would you? So we've also seen, after the master plan was signed, we've seen a shift in some of this production to Eswatini and Lesotho.
Yes.
Who do have a labor advantage. So, you know, I think the idea that you can interfere assumes that people just keep doing what they've always done. You know, if you interfere, they're not going to respond. But of course, when you interfere and you benefit one group of competitors, you're taking money and food out of the mouths of the others. They're not going to sit by passively and accept that. You know, so some will go out of business, but some will say, we've got to come up with another plan. And you can't kind of have this race to the bottom, you know, where government has to just give increasingly large amounts of support, you know, where we end up competing with other South African firms. I mean, not even China, but you've put in a group of South African firms who've signed up to the bargaining council to another group of firms who say we can't afford to sign up. It's no, I don't think that generates a good outcome, Peter.
It is remarkable. And what's interesting too is watching in the past couple of weeks, I've just been reading a lot about companies involved in the master plans. And the executives are rather, some of them, especially textiles, I have to say, sort of quite pleased with the way things are going. I mean, it's not, you know, they're not critical of the master plan. They enjoy being able to sit around the table and talk about their business with each other. And it struck me that, you know, this is precisely one of the reasons that the building industry got itself into such trouble, because it too once sat around and talked about things and got itself into a load of trouble because of it. But what Patel is demonstrating is that although he would prosecute you for collaborating outside of his master plan, he understands that collaboration within the master plan is helpful. And I'm just struck by how hypocritical that is.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really serious problem that you've touched on. So from a competition perspective, 2 or 3 years ago, the Competition Commission published a guideline that said, look, you shouldn't all sit in a room as competitors to figure out how to take control of the market. But if you're doing it in the interests of localization, then we're going to allow you to do that. I mean, whether that guideline is legal or not is something yet to be seen. But nevertheless, they published that, kind of giving permission for these sorts of groupings, as long as you have the noble cause of localization in mind, then it's acceptable. And to the CEOs of these businesses that are happy, I mean, of course they'd be happy, because the benefit, as I had mentioned earlier, Peter, of being in the room is tremendous. And their competitors who are not in the room are both deprived of access to data, of access to the minister. You know, no minutes are kept of these meetings. We have no idea what happens inside there. But we do know, if you have a look at that same article I'd written, that billions of rands have flowed to the signatories of the master plan. So, of course, if you're one of those beneficiaries, I'd also be quite happy. But the problem is they may represent the bulk of the big investors, but they certainly don't represent the majority of clothing producers in South Africa, for example. So everyone outside of that net.
Yeah. Donald, the money flows to them how? There are rebates on import duties, which are effectively a subsidy. How else does money go to the chosen few in the room?
Yes. So the import duties are an important component. I think Minister Patel, I forget the number now, but I think it was 700 million or thereabouts that has flowed. Now, you could say, well, that's not really a subsidy.
Just 700 million just in textiles, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So if you're a clothing manufacturer and you import the textiles and you're a signatory to the master plan and you've made your appropriate commitments, then you don't pay that duty. But all of your competitors do. Textile duties average out at about 22.5%. So if you've got a benefit of 22.5% compared to your smaller competitor up the road, you're going to put them out of business. Or they're going to shift to their procurement to Eswatini or something, where they can make that up with a lower labor cost. The other side is simply cash subsidies. The clothing and textile sector benefits to the tune of about 2 billion rand a year in money paid as a grant to the sector. So it's not only a duty rebate. There's cash grants paid. And those are paid to try to overcome the inefficiencies that signing on to the bargaining council creates, because of course you pay quite a hefty premium for your labor, etc. And so the subsidies attempt to compensate. But even with that, we've still seen employment drop over the last 5 years.
The Business Day the other day ran an editorial on Patel's sort of 5-year review. And it was kind of, sort of positive and negative in parts, but it did say, and I wondered about these when I read them. It says, considerable success was achieved on several fronts. Amongst the credits the department can claim are the success of the Black Industrialist Program, and I wondered how you measure that success, support for South Africa's motor industry. Well, I mean, you know, lots of industries are getting support. Enlightened regulation for special economic zones, a focused drive to recruit foreign investment, that didn't work. Attempts to reduce red tape, that hasn't worked either. And competition policy reforms allowing small and medium-sized companies to collaborate on research, development, and production without falling foul of competition authorities, which may or may not be a good thing. But he's getting quite an easy ride at the moment, Ibrahim Patel, isn't he?
Yeah, he certainly is, Peter. I would disagree with most of those statements.
Yes.
You know, if we just kind of pick on one of them for a moment. If we take the automotive sector, last year the automotive sector received direct subsidies of about 30 billion rand. If we just assume for a moment that the subsidies have been fairly constant and they've been in place for about 27 years now, so of course in nominal terms they were much lower beforehand, but if we kind of adjust for inflation and we say we've paid out an average of 30 billion a year in today's money, that's 810 billion rand that has been paid over to the sector, which is a staggering amount of money. Cars are more expensive in South Africa because of the support for the auto industry. And we haven't seen a blossoming of equally complex industries in South Africa. So the automotive industry hasn't given us, you know, building anything else other than cars. And if we stop putting the 30 billion rand a year in, then it also disappears. And that 30 billion rand a year goes to seven companies. So it's an enormous amount of money. You know, so has that been a success? I mean, I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think the answer is as simple as look at all the cars we manufacture.
But that's, you know, well, I mean, but they're also then saying, well, you know, look how many small companies are now making sort of car mirror holders or, you know, door handles or whatever it might be. I mean, that's, you know, we're supplying parts to the industry. That's a good thing, isn't it?
No, it's a very good thing. But we must remember something. Because of how the subsidies work, if you're a component manufacturer and you're making door mirrors for Ford, you can only get an incentive for the portion of mirrors that you sell to Ford, which means it's very difficult to grow your business. You lose the incentive if you, let's say, produce for the aftermarket, or if you say, you know what, I've gotten really good at producing mirrors, I'm going to try to export them. So you're connected to the OEM. Because you've got that direct connection, the OEMs have the ability to suck a significant portion of that value of the incentive out of the local producer onto themselves. Because who else do you go to? You know, if you're connected to Ford, you can't really move from there. You're very often not physically closely linked to where the OEM is. And your fortunes are tied to the OEM that you supply. So it becomes, I don't want to diminish the importance of the component manufacturers, but we shouldn't think we're creating an industry here, Peter. If you turn off the money tap, all of this evaporates, which means for as long as the taxpayers, the subsidies, yeah. If you stop providing the support, if you stop allowing the domestic producers to sell their cars at an inflated price locally, then you will... Yeah, you will shut down the industry. So, I mean, if we're going to keep making cars in South Africa, we need to be very comfortable with the idea that we will have to keep paying the car manufacturers to produce here.
Yeah? Donald McKay, thank you so much. We're going to stop there. I really appreciate you joining me. Thank you for all your insights and hope we see you here again soon. And thank you for listening. And remember what a relief it will be in just a few weeks to know exactly what South African think of their political leaders. I'll see you here again next week. Take care. Bye-bye.